Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I have turned much of my focus to mental health and well-being because I believe this is the foundation on which we build everything else. Like, our mental health is like the fuel that allows us to show up at work for our families and our communities and our schools. If our mental health is not good, it's hard to really thrive in the rest of our lives. And rebuilding that foundation is really what I want to dedicate my time and effort to.
Dr. Vivek Murthy is a physician. He's a vice admiral and the current Surgeon General of the United States. He was the 19th Surgeon General, and now he is, again, a Surgeon General, the 21st. And he has served under Presidents Obama, Trump, and Biden. We have all heard about the Surgeon General, the warning labels on alcohol, for example. But what does the nation's top doctor actually do? How does one become Surgeon General, and what are his most pressing concerns? Dr. Murthy joins me today to discuss these topics and others. And I must tell you, I really didn't know that you are part of the armed forces of the United States.
Yeah, so many people don't realize that the Surgeon General is actually the head of one of our eight uniformed services in the U.S. government. And the service that I have the privilege of leading is called the U.S. Public Health Service.
Right.
And we have about 6,000 nurses and doctors and pharmacists and physical therapists all over the country. We deploy them during times of emergency, whether hurricanes and tornadoes and other natural disasters, to help support local health care and public health.
So you must have been very busy with all the fires in not only Hawaii, but on the West Coast and in the Northeast. You've been very, very busy. And you are a young man. Vivek is how old?
I'm 46 now.
46 years old and very handsome, by the way, and dressed in his beautiful uniform. I hear you even walk in the morning in your uniform.
Well, yeah, I walk to work
miles?
As often
How many
as I
miles
can.
Do you walk to work?
Oh, it's not far. It's like a little over a mile.
Oh,
so not
okay.
far at all.
But you look very dapper and very
you.
Nice. And Dr. Murthy's come with some of his colleagues. What do they do?
Oh, my gosh. I have an incredibly talented team, and I've been blessed to have folks who help with communications, with our engagements with outside organizations. They also help with the design of our products and our website. And with running our operation, which is, while it's small and nimble, we operate in a fairly large bureaucracy of the United States government. And so the team helps me navigate all of that as we build out our initiatives on mental health and in other areas, and as we design projects and collaborations. The public health service, which I run, is much smaller. It's 6,000 officers who function across medical and health disciplines.
Yeah, I mean, and do you actually tell people where to go? It must be very complicated.
Well, it is complicated, but
how many people did you have to send to Hawaii?
We sent several dozen people to Hawaii to help specifically actually with the mental health challenges there. Because as you know, when natural disasters happen, a lot of times we rightly focus on the immediate destruction. But the mental health challenges, they last for a long time. even after the last house is rebuilt, last piece of debris is cleaned up, people will struggle. And in fact, sometimes those mental health challenges increase after all the public attention has gone away. People are left dwelling.
Just to clarify for the audience, what are the different divisions of the United States Armed Forces? There are eight?
So there are eight, I would say, of the uniformed services. Some of them are armed and some are not. So the United States Public Health Service, for example, this is a uniformed service that's focused on health. It's the only one that's solely focused on advancing the health of the country. Many people are familiar with the Army and the Navy and the Coast Guard, with Space Force, with other services.
Air Force?
Yes, Air Force as well. And there's NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So you put all of them together in different ways they serve to help protect our country, whether it's from outside threats or from health challenges we may face or other situations.
One of your biggest initiatives, and I know what you really want to talk about, and I do too, because I have a godchild who in England who started a company called Hello Tomo. Do you know about that?
No, I don't.
No, it's all about exactly your initiative, which is combating the epidemic of loneliness and isolation that is growing in all over the world, actually, right now. So, and I'm very happy to talk to you about what you are doing to help combat this loneliness and this sense of isolation that's occurring. What is this a direct result of, basically?
Well, I think to really understand that, we have to recognize that loneliness has been building for years. It's not something that happened overnight. The pandemic made it worse, but it was a crisis even before the pandemic, a silent crisis, if you will. And there's several things that have been happening over the last several decades that have led to that. So one is that over the last half century, our participation in the organizations that used to bring us together, like recreational leagues, service organizations, faith organizations, has steadily declined. The other thing that's happened is that as we've come to use technology more, which has been really wonderful in efficiency producing, it's also made it unnecessary for us to see people as much. So for example, I don't need to go to the grocery store or to a retail store to buy things. I can just buy things online, and that can save me some time. One of the consequences we've realized is we have less interaction with one another. We also move around a lot more. We change jobs. We leave, you know, home for school. Those are communities we leave behind. Again, some benefits there, but there's a cost. And finally, I think that the phenomenon of social media for many people has actually led to an antisocial effect, which is that many of them have found that they're substituting what used to be in-person connections for online connections, where they're less known, they have less of a strong, you know, sort of, I think, personal connection with other people. And that has left many people lonelier and more isolated than before. The thing that concerns me most, Martha, is when you look across the age spectrum at who's most affected, we find that one in two adults are living with measurable levels of loneliness in America, but the numbers are even greater among young people. And depending on the study you look at, somewhere between 70 to 75% of young people say that they are, in fact, struggling with loneliness.
Yeah, it makes me very unhappy to hear that. Hmm. I remember when I was just out of college, starting a good job on Wall Street, I would get about 100 phone calls a day from different people. And I really liked that because I got to talk to people in a job, but also at home. And that verbal communication was so important to me. Mm-hmm. Now, if I count 10 phone calls a day, that's a lot. Mm. And I hate it. And my colleagues here at the office, they text from one desk to another. That's what they do. They text. And that's what's happening everywhere. I mean, my granddaughter texts me. Mm-hmm. Instead of picking up the phone, I always write, please call me. I get a text. Busy right now. I'll text you later. Mm. You know, and she's 12.
Yeah.
And I know she's not with anybody, but she's gotten into this bad, I think it's a horrible habit, by the way, because I might be very old fashioned, but text, how much do you text versus call?
Well, so I'll tell you, I've changed in the last couple of years, in part because of a lot of this work we've been doing on loneliness. I used to primarily send people texts. I wasn't leaving people voicemails either. I had to call them, I would. If I couldn't reach them, I would just text them or email them. But I had this friend, actually, who whenever we used to play phone tag and he couldn't reach me, he would actually leave me a long voicemail. And I actually realized I really enjoyed just hearing his voice. And exactly. I also started to pick up the phone more often when people called, even if it was busy, because I would just say, hey, can I call you back? Like, I'm about to walk into a meeting. Mm-hmm. And even that 5 seconds or 10 seconds, hearing their voice made a difference.
Well, not only does it help you, it also, help them to get a voice, but you know that you're going to call back. You're making you're making a note to yourself that you're going to actually correspond with that person.
That's right.
In words.
And the thing is that there's a whole evolutionary scientific basis to the fact that you and I feel better with phone calls, which is that, like, you know, thousands of years ago when we were evolving, we came to not just process the words that somebody was saying, but their facial expression, the tone of their voice, their body language.
Yeah.
All of that went into us understanding who they were, our connection, and
what
was
being
transacted.
And now you don't see people. You just don't see them.
Yeah.
You're definitely onto a major problem here. And I congratulate you on doing that, because I think people have to know this. As you say, especially children. Mm. I mean, 11 and 12, the two grandchildren that I care most about, luckily they have school. Luckily they have a school to go to. During COVID, the girl did not like being alone. Mm-hmm. She wanted to see her friends. The boy, I'm so happy, he said, I can get all my homework done by 8:30 in the morning, and then I can do whatever I want to do, which is kick a soccer ball and read. And he's okay with that, but she's not. And she needs that social life, that correspondence with others in physical ways.
You know, the truth is every kid needs that at some level. Some may need more than others, but they all need it. And I think that's one of the reasons the pandemic was so tough for them. But it's also one of the reasons I worry, Martha, that even when many kids are in school today, they are on their phones and they're not actually interacting as much with each other. I've had so many young people, when I do roundtables around the country, tell me, hey, I want to talk to other people, but at lunchtime, everyone's on their phone. And in between classes, they're on their phones.
But why do schools allow phones?
I think
during class, they shouldn't allow them.
So I do believe that there need to be stronger limitations and restrictions on phones in school. I think many schools have not necessarily known what the right policies are. Some of them have policies, but they're not sure how to enforce them. I think many teachers rightly, have felt like, hey, I don't want to be the enforcer on top of everything else I'm doing. So then this question of how to enforce it kind of comes to play. But I think that these are issues that we have to find solutions to, because one of the challenges is that with having your cell phone on you all the time is not only that you don't connect with other people, but it's also that it impairs your attention and in a learning environment. And so I think about a few key areas that we need to protect in our lives from our phones and technology. One of them is our sleep. And too often our phones invade our bedrooms and they're stealing hours away from sleep. The second is in-person interaction, where they often distract us and impair and I think weaken our connections with others. So when you're talking to friends, when you're having dinner and catching up with family, do that without your phones. The third is where we learn. And that's where I think keeping schools in particular to be an area where the use of technology is limited, specifically your phones, is important. And the final area is actually physical activity. You know, one of the consequences of spending 3.5 hours a day on your devices, which is the average amount that adolescents spend each day.
Isn't that crazy?
But there's certain things you're not doing. And one of those, I worry is the cost comes from your time to be physically active. These are, as I think of it, pillars for health and well-being.
Now, can you have an effect on this? Can you impose some rules or encourage schools to clamp down on the use of phones and maybe put your phone in a cubbyhole in the morning and you get it back in the afternoon?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So while most of the rules around schools are made locally in the United States by local school districts, one thing our office can do and what we have done is to push forward strong recommendations to schools of what they can do. And already since we issued our advisory on social media and youth mental health in May of this year, we've actually seen more schools taking actions. I was actually just at one school in Indiana, for example, that told me when I went to visit, that after our advisory came out, they finally put in strong rules around not using your phone during schools. And what they said, it's very interesting. They found that the volume has gone up in a good way. They hear more kids talking to each other in school. The second thing they've noticed is they see more kids playing with one another, playing Jenga, they mentioned, and other games with one another. This is what childhood should be about. It should be about playing, about connecting with one another, about discovering through our relationships. And I think to do that, we need to protect some of our time without our devices in school.
Well, you were the 19th U.S. Surgeon General and now the 21st Surgeon General. Your role how did it change from 19th to 21st?
COVID was happening when I took office the second time around. It was in March of 2021. We were about a year into the COVID pandemic.
Right.
The other thing that was different, and this in a saddening way, is that the mental health crisis in our country was worse. The polarization that we were experiencing in division was worse than even it was when I was Surgeon General the first time. So all of this was deeply worrisome to me. And it was one of the reasons why, even though I did a lot of work on COVID in the beginning, I have turned much of my focus to mental health and well-being, because I believe this is the foundation on which we build everything else. Like, our mental health is like the fuel that allows us to show up at work for our families and our communities and our schools. Our mental health is not good, it's hard to really thrive in the rest of our lives. And rebuilding that foundation is really what I want to dedicate my time and effort to.
What is your education? What enabled you to get a job as Surgeon General of the United States?
Well, I'll tell you a funny thing, Martha, is that I actually never thought I would serve in this role. I never aspired to, but I also actually never thought I would work in government.
Yeah, well, you hadn't thought about it, right? Is that?
I had not, no. I was happily building a life outside of government. At the time I was asked to serve in this role, I was working as a doctor. I was teaching medical students and residents. I was building a technology company, actually, at the time, because I was very interested in how technology could be used to advance research and health. And I was starting to get involved in doing some work around advocacy for a better healthcare system, because I had been working as a doctor for enough years at that point that I realized there were just fundamental things that were broken about our system that weren't serving patients well. And I wanted to be a voice for correcting those and for organizing other doctors to use their voice to do the same. So that's what I was doing beforehand. My birthday, actually, in 2013, received this call out of the blue from a 202 area code number. And I knew enough to know that 202 was Washington, D.C., but I didn't know which number it was. And to compound things, I had actually just come off of a red-eye flight from L.A. I was living in Boston at the time. I just wanted to go to bed, honestly. And my hands were full of my dry cleaning that I just picked up at the dry cleaners. But the phone rings, and I almost didn't pick it up. And that ended up being a call from the White House asking me if I wanted to be considered for the position of Surgeon General. And I'll tell you, Martha, at that time, that even though I didn't think that government was really a place for me, what I did realize was there was something actually very unusual about this job, which is that it was an independent job where you are, even though you're appointed by a president, your job is not to execute the agenda of a president or a political party or anyone else. Your agenda is devised by you based on science and the public interest. And so to me, I like that independence. I like the idea of being able to focus on the issues that I thought were most important to the public. And in the end of the day, I'm grateful that I was
asked. Commander-in-chief your commander?
Ultimately, yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
He is.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
He doesn't set your agenda.
He does not. And one thing I'm grateful for is that this was true, not just for President Biden, but it was true with President Obama as well, is both of them understood the role well enough and had enough respect for the sacred nature of the role and also for the importance of science as a driver for what the Surgeon General's agenda is, that they never came to me and said, you need to do this, or you should focus on this because this is my agenda. They always gave me the opportunity and freedom to identify what I thought was most important for the country and to focus on that, and I'm grateful for that.
So who was the 20th?
So the 20th Surgeon General was Jerome Adams, who was appointed by President Trump to be Surgeon General. He served in particular during that first year of the COVID-19 pandemic, and he used to be the health commissioner in the state of Indiana prior to serving as Surgeon General. He worked incredibly hard, traveled all over the country during COVID, even before there was a vaccine available. You know, so he was putting himself at risk, but he did it because it was his job, and he wanted to serve. I was Surgeon General with Ebola and with the Zika virus as well.
Right. Sure.
There's a lot of times where things are changing rapidly and you're figuring things out. And as you do that, sometimes your recommendations change. So there were times in the first year of the pandemic in the Trump administration with Dr. Adams where they were rapidly evaluating new data, and sometimes their recommendations were changing. I think sometimes people would look at that and say, well, if you said do something on day one and then day 30 you're saying do something different, that must mean that you don't know what you're doing. But that's actually the nature of what you want the scientific discovery process to be with.
Things happen so fast.
They happen really fast,
And
this was, with COVID in particular, was a time where we were not only trying to learn from what was happening in the U.S., but we were gathering data from all around the world.
I was doing a sculpture at the time.
I'm
not a sculptress, but I was, you know, this is stay at home. Uh-huh. This is of that first 100 days, I started a sculpture, which was in the shape of a giant egg, and all my colored eggs from my chickens were blown out and being placed on this giant sculpture. And I didn't know how many eggs it would take to cover this giant egg. But on the eggs, I was writing, when things happened during COVID, you know, when somebody famous died or when somebody contracted COVID or when some new vaccine was being promoted. Mm. And so I wrote these all down on these eggs. And it was just incredible, the change of things happening, as you say, so fast.
Yeah.
And when I look back on those eggs now, it's the history of COVID.
Yeah.
And the dates, I put dates on them, and I would people would die, and the number of people hospitalized. Oh, my gosh. It was the most awful time in recent, well, recent history, that kind of national awful time.
Yeah.
But I can understand. I mean, your job was so difficult. And Dr. Adams' job, of course, was so difficult because he had believers and disbelievers around him at
That's
all
right.
times.
So. Martha, how did you manage during that first year of COVID? I know it was a very isolating year for people.
So productive because I was living on my farm, so I could, I didn't have to go to the store. I could just eat out of the garden and eat from the chickens, you know, all the eggs and, you know.
And where was the farm?
In Bedford, New York. So close to New York.
Gotcha.
And I built I had an extra house on the property. We turned that into a TV studio. And so we did three television shows, big shows, 13 episodes each show that year.
Wow.
And we were tested every day. We had the tester at the gate for people to come in. They had to be tested and wait for the test to come back. Mm. We were all very careful, and we really were extremely productive. Mm. And we didn't come to New York because this office was closed. It was a miserable time. Mm. But in the first 100 days, I kept 5 people at my house, and I cooked 100 different meals.
Oh,
and we recorded everything. It was kind of interesting. And everybody had a good time. And I allowed every night, I have a wine cellar, but I'm not a serious wine collector, but I had some pretty good wine cellar. everyone was allowed to choose a different wine every night. One wine, and we brought it up and we looked it up online. One night it was a $2,000 bottle. One night it was a $19.99 bottle of wine, you know. And everyone, we laughed so much and we played cards. We were not isolated at all because we had 5 of us living there. We actually had fun.
Yeah.
But we knew how serious this all was. And we could do this. And I had constant conversations with my daughter, with the kids in the city who were much more isolated because of where they were. But it was an interesting time. But we were very productive.
And that's a bond the 5 of you always have going through that time.
And not only that, there was no chance to get depressed, no chance to feel isolated in any way because we couldn't. But so few people had that opportunity. I mean, people who, a family of 3 in New York stuck in an apartment with a little baby or something, it's horrible.
Yeah, I think it was incredibly hard for many families. And I think for people who had to go to work in settings where there may not have been a lot of precautions taken.
Oh, yes, well, public service workers.
Right, and many of them felt like they were putting their lives at risk in many cases there were, but they had to come back and take care of their families. Yeah. And it was a very hard time for
people.
But
it also got me really to be a believer in the vaccines and to take care and just do the stuff that you had to do.
Yeah.
And believe in science, right?
And in many ways, I think what we saw, even despite all the challenges along the way, is we saw a vaccine developed in a remarkably short period of time with the right safety checks taken, you know, to make sure that it was okay for the population.
Did your office have a lot to do with that?
So the vaccine was developed during the last year of the Trump administration. So this was before I came back to serve as Surgeon General the second time. But I do think it's important to credit them for the work they did in getting the vaccine developed so quickly. The Biden administration then took that baton and then really ran a historic vaccination campaign around the country that vaccinated more people in a shorter amount of time than I believe any other vaccination campaign that we've had.
Yes.
To me, that was a great example of how two administrations could actually do a good job, you know, in concert with one another, even though they were subsequent, obviously, but they both had an important piece of the puzzle that they helped put together to get us through COVID.
Was it hard to transition from, what did you do in between?
Yeah, so in between, I was actually doing a portfolio of things. I spent some time writing a book, ironically, on loneliness and isolation. I didn't know the pandemic was coming, but it came out in the first month of the pandemic. I was also...
Last night, I was talking to a biochemist.
Yeah.
I mentioned that I was going to be speaking to him. He said, oh, he wrote an amazing book
on
isolation.
Nice. Well, it was a labor of love, and it was really, in many ways, personally motivated as well, because I, as myself, have struggled a lot with loneliness over the years, as a child in particular.
Are you an only child?
I'm not, actually. I have a wonderful sister who's a year older to me. And I never felt lonely at home. This is important. My parents loved me unconditionally, and my sister did, and I knew that, which was a saving grace for me. But when I left home and went to school, that's when things broke down for me because I was very shy. I was introverted as well. It was hard for me to make friends, even though I wanted to. And so I would go to school each day. And the day, you know what time I dreaded the most in school, Martha? It was lunchtime. Walking into the cafeteria and not knowing if there was somebody to sit next to or not before I'd be alone. And in, it's funny, in recent years, I've talked to some of my friends from elementary school. And I've told them a little bit about how I was feeling. And all of them said, oh, wow, I felt the same way, but I thought I was the only one. Mm. It turns out many of us were struggling with loneliness, but we thought we were the only one. And that turns out to be the case for many people during adulthood as well. So that's why, for me, there was a big personal motivation to write this, because not only had I been affected by it personally, had I taken care of many patients over the years who struggled with loneliness, but when I was Surgeon General the first time around and traveled the country, I encountered so many people, students, retired folks, younger parents, who were all saying to me that they felt invisible. They felt if they disappeared tomorrow, no one would care, and they felt profoundly alone.
Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Well, you wrote that your advisory, Our Epidemic of Loneliness and Isolation, beginning of this year in 2023.
That's right.
And how do people get this?
So you can find this just on our website, surgeongeneral.gov. And that'll take you to our priorities. And this is one of our key ones, loneliness and isolation. And in it, what we laid out was both the extent of the problem, you know, noting in particular that 1 in 2 adults are struggling with loneliness and even more kids are and young adults. But we also laid out what we can do about it as individuals, as organizations, schools and workplaces, as neighborhoods and as government. So my hope, even though loneliness itself is a profound challenge, I wanted people to understand why it's so important for us to address, because this isn't just one more health issue in the long list of health issues for the country to deal with. But what we realize is that when people struggle with loneliness and isolation, when they're disconnected, their chances and risk of depression, anxiety, and suicide all go up. But their risk of physical illness goes up too. They have a 29% increase in the rate of a risk of heart disease, 31% increase in the risk of stroke, 50% increase in the risk of dementia among older people, and the risk of premature death goes up as well. Hmm. We actually noted also that the mortality impact, Martha, that you see with being disconnected from others is similar to the mortality impact we see with smoking daily. It's even greater than the mortality impact we see with obesity. And
so it is an epidemic.
It truly is. And this is one of the reasons I wanted people to know that loneliness is more than a bad feeling. It's a public health concern that we've got to take seriously. And the good news is we can do a lot about it. You know, we don't have to wait for Congress to pass a law, you know, to address loneliness. There are things we can do in our day-to-day lives to help strengthen connection and rebuild our relationships.
So you have to get that message out.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And how are you doing that?
So you were doing it through a lot of podcasts like this, through going to events and talking to people, to visiting communities across the country. But we're also next week, actually in just a few days, we're going to be launching a college campus tour as well, where we're going to universities around the country to talk about the loneliness crisis, but also to talk optimistically about how we can come together to now rebuild social connection. And this is a place, Martha, where I actually think that even though young people are struggling the most with loneliness and isolation, I really think that a movement of young people to rebuild connection can help lead our country forward in shifting how we engage with one another, in rebuilding and knitting back into our culture the importance of relationships. You know, I think, Martha, I think the reason we became lonely is not because one day we decided relationships weren't important. I don't think that happened. I think we've always known at some deeper level that our relationships are important. But I think what happened is that we just allowed our relationships to drift away as technology came in and our time got sort of occupied with work and other things. We allowed more and more things to reduce the time that we spent in person with one another. And as people fell lower and lower on our priority list, we became lonelier, but we thought we were the only ones. Part of my goal in this advisory is for people to realize if you're struggling with loneliness and isolation,
you're not alone.
You're not alone. You're not the only one. Many of us are. And that's why it's important for us to talk about it and to start addressing it.
Yeah, when the computer became a common tool, mm-hmm. I remember saying to everybody, oh my gosh, this is the best thing because it's going to enable us to get our work done faster, to make time, to spend time with our families, to let us go on more vacations, to really enjoy life a little bit more. How wrong I was.
Mm.
You know, it really made, it was such a different result because what it did was become all-consuming.
Yeah.
And that computer, that handheld, that, you know, first it was the desktop, then it became the tablet, then it became the iPhone, so important to us. And we carry it around like the most treasured thing with us all the time. It has to be charged, it has to be this, it has to be that. And it really did take away a lot of free time. Because, really, as you say, kids don't go and play sports. They're rather looking at their phone. What are they looking at? They're looking at Instagram. They're looking at TikToks. They're looking at inanity sometimes, right?
They are. And the truth is, like, I don't entirely blame kids for this because some people say, hey.
No, you can't. You know, you can't blame the
yeah,
kid.
Yeah, I think what's happened is the environment has changed around them. And many of these devices, as you know, Martha, the devices themselves and social media in particular have been designed to capture all of our attention.
Oh, yes.
And to maximize how much time we spend on it. Like what I care about when I think about my kids, and I care about a lot of this first and foremost as a parent of a 5 and 7-year-old. Thankfully, they're not on social media or tech yet, but that day is coming and I know it. But, you know, we think a lot of times when our kids are on these devices about the fact that we want them to spend their time well. We care about time well spent, not quantity of time spent as much, but they're designed to maximize quantity of time spent. And that's what I worry about. And it's one of the reasons why in the advisory, one of the things I called for government to do is to put real safety standards in place that are actually enforced, that have teeth, so that when parents are introducing their kids to social media, they understand that that it has been vetted, that safety measures have been put in place that are adequate. Many companies will say now that they put safety measures in place. But what I care about as a parent is, are they enough? Are they working to keep my child safe? Or are they manipulating my child to spend more and more time on them, exposing them to harmful content, exposing them to harassment from others? And unfortunately, that is the common experience that many kids are going through today. It's just not right, but it's also fixable, but it has to be addressed with urgency.
Well, do you have a rule of thumb for when children should get their iPhone?
That's a great question. So here's how I think about it. The challenge with getting a phone today is that it comes with a whole bunch of other stuff. Many parents get a phone for safety reasons. Want their child to be able to call in case of an emergency, right? But with that, you're buying access to the internet more broadly, to social media in particular. So here's how I think about it. For my own kids, my plan is to delay the use of social media until past middle school, and then to reevaluate when they're in high school based on whether there are safety standards in place, based on what the data says at that time about their safety, and based on their maturity. Now, I know that's not gonna be easy, because there's a lot of peer pressure to get on your devices and on social early. So my wife and I are planning to partner with as many other parents as we can in this, knowing that there's strength in numbers and our kids then won't be the only kids who are delaying use. But for safety purposes, there are more and more parents who are getting their kids what some people call dumb phones, right? Which are phones that don't necessarily have all the bells and whistles in terms of social media access, but they can make phone calls. They can text.
Right.
In a case of an emergency, you can reach your parent if you're a child and vice versa.
But no access to the other stuff.
Exactly.
Oh.
And I think that's actually very, very an appropriate middle ground.
Dumb phones. I didn't even know about dumb phones.
Look, I know there's a lot of pressure here. And this is one of those things where I think the thing that worries me as a parent, Martha, is I think we put the entire burden of managing all of this, technology and social media in particular, on the shoulders of parents. And we've said, good luck.
Yeah.
And we just walked away as a society. And I just think that is wrong. You know, the vast majority
without
of parents...
Without offering the guidance that they really need.
Right? Yeah, and the support. Like, you know, when I was old enough to drive, my parents didn't need to go and check the braking system on every car, investigate mm-hmm. the transmission, test out the frame with hammers themselves
right.
to make sure it was strong enough. There were safety standards in place so that they knew if they bought a car that it
you
met those safety standards.
You would be safe, right.
But parents should be able to expect the same thing from the technology that their kids use.
That's a very good point. I don't know if you know this, but at Mount Sinai, we have the Martha Stewart Center for Living. And we've long focused on the impact of isolation and with older people. I mean, it's been, especially in a cityscape like New York, the loneliness, is it more prevalent in a crowded city or less prevalent loneliness?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think it honestly depends on the culture of the city. I think when you have a city where people are, look, people have said this to me about New York City, while there, I think the Department of Public Health here has recognized loneliness as a problem. They're trying to build tools, you know, for people to engage more with one another, hotlines for people to call who are in crisis. The truth is you've got a lot of people together, but a lot of times they're not paying attention to each other, right? We're on our phones even when we're walking down the streets, right? So when we're in cafes, we're doing our own thing. We're just not, when we're on the subway, you know, we're catching up on emails, looking at social on the phone. We're passing by each other, but we're not engaging with one another. And I think that can lead the people to a profound sense of loneliness. You know, in rural areas, I think the challenge of isolation is real. You know, and a lot of times you may have a lot less interaction. But one of the things that we have realized is what matters, Martha, is the quality and not the quantity of your connections. If you have two or three people in your life who know you, who you can go to during a crisis, who you can show up for during a crisis, that can be more invaluable to you than having 100 friends who are your contacts on social media, but who you don't really feel you can be yourself with, who you can't be vulnerable with. But the good news, I think, is that as huge as the problem is, it is small steps, actually, Martha, that can make a huge difference.
Like what are those? What are those small steps?
So here are some simple things I would offer to individuals. If you were to spend 15 minutes a day reaching out to someone that you cared about, it could be just to say, hey, I'm thinking about you. I want to know how you're doing. It could be a phone call. It could be swinging by their home if you live in the same neighborhood. Mm-hmm. It could be a text to say, hey, I'm thinking about you. That can make a difference in how you feel. The second thing is if you take the time that you have with people and actually give them the benefit and the blessing of your full attention by putting your device away during that short time you're with them, that can have the effect of stretching time. It can make 15 minutes feel like it's an hour.
Start a bridge club, right?
Yeah, and activities help a lot too, right? And so whether it's a bridge club, whether it's a volunteer activity, it turns out that when we serve other people, that's actually one of the most powerful antidotes to loneliness. And service doesn't always have to be volunteering an organization. It could be recognizing there's somebody at my workplace who's having a hard time. And just offering to help them out or lending a listening ear.
I want to touch base.
That's great.
Yeah, I want to touch base. And I worry about some of my friends. You know, they don't have to worry about me as much as I have to worry about them.
Yeah.
It's something that I take seriously.
Well, I think it makes a big difference. I mean, I imagine if your friends, you know, have a need and you're reaching out to them, which it sounds like is what's happening. Well, it means a lot to them to know that you're thinking of them.
Oh, yeah.
And that
I think so. It's a tough challenge. I'm so happy that you're bringing it to the forefront. I think it's very important.
Thank you.
And I hate that it's called an epidemic, but I can see why.
Yeah. And unfortunately, Martha, it turns out we're not the only country also dealing with this.
No, England is right now. I mean, I did tell you, my godson, Augustine Booth Cliburn, started a company with his partner who was a Saudi prince. Hmm. They started this company called Hello Tomo. Hmm. When he told me about it about 5 years ago, I said, what the heck are you doing? He said, I just had a call out of Cambridge, and he's starting this company dealing. He says, there's so much loneliness in our country, and we're trying to make an app so that people can connect via our app, Hello Tomo. Mm-hmm. And he sold it for a lot of money to a much bigger company, very involved in loneliness epidemic and isolation. And he's now working for that larger company. Mm. But he said, he just wrote to me yesterday because I reached out and said, just tell me a little bit about what your job entails now. He said, you know, I'm in charge of reaching out around the world to other people who are working for this much larger company, but we're on Zoom. Mm. And he said, I'm not seeing these people in the flesh. And I'm feeling isolated now. Mm. And they're trying to help all the other people around them, but they're on Zooms. And they're on, you know, and not seeing anybody.
Yeah.
He says it's like a nightmare for him that he's not talking to anybody in person. Do you know this company, Lyra? You have to look it up. You have to look it up and see what exactly they're doing. But he was one of the new entrepreneurs, 40 under 40 in England, you know, for the Forbes thing. And it's so interesting to see that he's experiencing what he's trying to solve.
And I'm really impressed that he recognized this as an issue more than 5 years ago. A lot of other workplaces are dealing with the same challenge of like how, especially after the pandemic, where so many people started working virtually.
Okay, well, tell me about that, because I want to know what you think about a 3-day work week as opposed to a 5-day work week. Mm-hmm. I mean, was it I think it was 1930s when we became a 5-day a week workplace after 6 days, and no pay was cut. The president did not cut pay, or somebody didn't cut the pay. And I thought the 5-day work week seems reasonable. And what do you think of this 3-day work week that everybody's following now?
Gosh, well, I hadn't heard about the 3-day work week overall. What I have heard about is companies that are devising policies to bring people back for 2 or 3 days a week and then let them work virtually for a couple of days a week. And look, I think I recognize that people are trying to strike a balance. There's some families and individuals for whom having that flexibility to work virtually can be very powerful in terms of saving on commute times, being able to make it home to have dinner with your kids, you know, or pick them up from school. Like, those are really valuable and powerful. There's also, you have to balance that, I think, with sort of the cost of never being together, which creates its own loneliness at
work.
In
a creative company, it's very difficult.
Yes, and I'm glad you mentioned creativity, because one of the interesting things that one of my former business school professors studied and taught me was that when people struggle with loneliness and disconnection in the workplace, it actually negatively impacts their creativity, retention, as well as their overall productivity. And that's, so that matters a lot. But much harder to forge those relationships when you don't at least have some in-person time. Now, for some companies, that might mean being in person a couple of days a week. For others, it may be more or less frequently. But this is where I think it's really important to recognize that there is a cost to being virtual, all virtual, all the time. You lose those connections, and those matter tremendously to our satisfaction and to our overall productivity.
Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all 6 delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
The college tour sounds very good. Are you going to be going to your alma maters, Harvard and Yale?
No, unfortunately not on the college, this college tour. We'll be starting actually at Duke University and then going to many other places from there. It'll be a chance for us to talk about the power of social connection. We're going to have actually, we've set up an experiential sort of afternoon with the students where we'll be actually engaging with them in some actual exercises that, through which they can build connection. We're actually putting forward a challenge to them as well with something we call our 5 for 5 challenge, which is we're asking them to take 5 days and each of those 5 days to reach out to someone and experience human connection and to do so doing one of three things, either expressing gratitude to someone, lending support to someone, or asking for help. And it could be something as simple as calling a friend to say, hey, you know, that thing that you did for me last month when you helped me when I needed to move, that meant a lot to me. Thanks for doing that. It could be asking somebody, or lending support. If you had a friend who had a hard time, you know, that let's say they broke up with someone recently and they're struggling, just calling them to say, hey, I'm just checking on you. I just want to know how you're doing. I know the last month has been pretty rough on you. But it could also be asking for help. This is something that is tough for us to do now, but calling someone and even a good friend to say, look, I am struggling. I'm having a hard time. Do you think you could help me out? Maybe could we hang out? Or, you know, I might need help, you know, doing this, you know, activity in my life. Can you come with me? That might be hard to do, but two things happen when you ask for help. One is you get help more often than not. And people are more willing to help us than we realize. Studies show we often underestimate people's willingness to help us. But the other thing that happens when you ask for help is you tell the other person that it's okay to ask for help. They're probably somebody who might be struggling with thinking, I have a need. Is it okay for me to ask for help? So we can be examples, you know, in asking for help and make it easier for other people to do the same. But in these three ways, you know, again, expressing gratitude, lending support, or asking for help, we're asking people to do this each day over the course of 5 days and then to let us know how they feel afterward, to tag, you know, three other friends and ask them to take that challenge. And by doing so, we're hoping to create the experience of connection and hopefully make this more part of people's day-to-day lives.
Well, I certainly hope your message of connection resonates. I really do.
Thanks.
Because I think we need it so much. And it's very hard to believe that we are in trouble like this culturally and politically at such odds with so many other things, really. Previous surgeon generals have tackled smoking. Mm-hmm. They've tackled drinking. And so these awareness campaigns really have a tremendous impact, don't they?
Well, I like to think they do. They're not the entire solution, but they can be catalysts for a lot of the actions that we need to solve these public health issues.
Well, smoking certainly. Was the whole clampdown on smoking, was that the Surgeon General?
Yes. So in 1964, that was Surgeon General Luther Terry.
I remember that whole campaign. I was so happy because I hated smoking so much, even though I had to learn how to smoke for a Tarrytown commercial.
Really?
Yeah, when I was like 16, they made me learn how to smoke, inhale, and I had to blow smoke out of my mouth. You know? And I thought, oh God, this is the worst thing on earth.
Yeah, that was important, and that was a multi-year campaign. But the smoking rates, Martha, in the United States at that time were around 42%.
I know, it was horrible.
It was terrible, and now, thankfully, we're under 13%.
But not enough.
Not enough.
I mean,
but
not
a lot
enough.
Of progress.
I mean, boy, there's so many people smoking, you know, mm-hmm. everywhere.
Yeah.
And what about drinking? Drinking, a doctor just told me that there's this big list of dangerous things to take into your body.
Mm.
And the most dangerous of all, out of 40 things, is alcohol.
Yeah, so alcohol
is the most dangerous. I mean, above heroin.
Well, so I think a lot of this depends on how you're using these substances. The thing about alcohol is that, you know, back in 2016, when I was Surgeon General the first time, I issued a report on alcohol, drugs, and health.
You did.
Yeah, and the alcohol was a part of it because I think many people had, I think, somehow erroneously felt that alcohol is just not a big deal because it's legal, it's not, doesn't have any health risks associated with it. But, you know, sadly, we have, you know, many people who are addicted to alcohol. We have many people who drink excessively, and alcohol leads to a significant amount of disease and death each year in our country and causes us a tremendous amount in terms of lives lost, but also in terms of money spent on healthcare costs and economic productivity losses. In fact, when we detail the overall cost of addiction in the country, the hundreds of millions of dollars, the majority of that actually was related to alcohol, really? Not to other drugs. Mm-hmm. And so it's important for us to recognize that. I think many people also don't recognize that kids are still drinking, like underage. It was a problem when I was growing up. It continues to be a problem today. Thankfully, there's been some improvement there, and based on recent data in terms of underage drinking, that's a good thing. But you know, this is a place where we have to be vigilant. I worry that similar things happen with smoking. Many people think that smoking is not a problem anymore, that we solved that problem. It was only a problem 50 years ago. But we still have millions of people who are struggling with smoking. We still lose nearly 500,000 people to tobacco-related disease wow. each year in the United States.
And opioids?
The opioid epidemic is deeply concerning because we are seeing continued increases in the rate of overdose deaths.
Oh, we are.
Oh. We are. We've seen that growth curve start to level off over the past year or two, but still at dangerously high levels. And one of the challenges, Martha, is people, when they thought about opioids, they used to think about heroin, they would think about oxycodone, the pills that people were taking. But now, increasingly, what we're seeing is that there's an even more powerful form of opioids called fentanyl, which is now poisoning more dangerous.
Bad poison. Yeah.
Yes, the supply of opioids is such that many people don't even know they're taking products that contain fentanyl. But because it is so strong, it can overwhelm your respiratory system and lead people to stop breathing and ultimately can lead to death. And so that is a big part, fentanyl, of what is driving the opioid overdose crisis today.
Well, COVID. Can you talk about long COVID? What is that about?
So long COVID is a syndrome where people experience prolonged symptoms long after their initial episode of COVID has resolved. And those symptoms could be shortness of breath, could be fatigue, it could be overall muscle aches and pains, it could be dizziness and vertigo. There's a whole host of symptoms that can go along with long COVID. President Biden actually directed the administration, the Department of Health and Human Services, to stand up an initiative to understand more clearly what drives long COVID, what are the risk factors for it, and most importantly, how do we treat it? Mm. How do we address it?
Is there a treatment?
So right now, there isn't a definitive cure, if you will, for long COVID. It's a lot of patients with long COVID end up working with clinicians who try to manage some of their individual symptoms. But we need a more comprehensive understanding of how to diagnose and treat and prevent long COVID. The good news is that there's a lot now more attention and money going in to addressing that. Now, the bad news is it can't come quickly enough because there are many people in the United States and around the world who are suffering with long COVID. I know many of them. I've had the chance to sit and talk with them and understand what it's like. It is debilitating for many of them. It's taken away their quality of life. And you can imagine that with that have come mental health strain and mental health challenges as well.
Yeah, big challenge. What about obesity?
Mm-hmm.
Is that still considered a very serious disease here in the United States?
Absolutely. Our rates of obesity have unfortunately continued to go the wrong way. More than 40% of adults in America are living with obesity. Equally, if not more concerning, around 20% of our kids are now obese. This is a dramatic change from over the last 20 years. Yes. And we're talking about obesity. There are even a greater number who are actually obese or overweight, right? So the reason we get so concerned about obesity is because it puts people at risk for high blood pressure, for other forms of heart disease, for diabetes. And then there are other concerns as well. With obesity, you imagine your body is carrying a lot of weight that puts more strain on your joints. You think about the development of arthritis and other musculoskeletal conditions, which can impact your quality of life. So these are profound challenges, and I worry that part of what is driving them is that our food environment has changed dramatically over the last half century. We have much more highly processed foods and foods with high levels of refined sugars, which we know contribute to the obesity epidemic.
So as a doctor, What advice do you wish we would all hear?
There are a few basic pillars, which if we focus on can give us a good shot at living a healthy life. One of those pillars is around sleep. Getting 7 to 9 hours of sleep a night really matters for your health, physical and mental. The second is around our physical activity. Just being able to, even if you don't have time to go to the gym every day and work out, just walking, making sure that you're walking whenever you can to stay physically active, that matters. The third has to do with your nutrition. We all probably could do more when it comes to drinking more water and eating more fruits and vegetables and reducing our intake of highly processed foods. And finally, there's our relationships, which are just as important as the other three. Spending a little time each day connecting with people we love and care about, reaching out to friends, being there to support coworkers, that can go a long way toward making us feel like we have a true social network and a social safety net, which all of us need, whether we say it or not, but not all of us have.
Well, thank you so much. This has been such an interesting conversation for me, and I know for all of our listeners. Dr. Murthy, you are fantastic, and all of you out there can listen to House Calls with Dr. Vivek Murthy whenever you listen to podcasts.
Well, thank you.
Thank you,
thank you so,
so
much,
very much. And good luck on the college tour.
Thank you. I'm very excited.
You might
about
enroll
it.
Now for, is there any other degree that you could possibly get?
I think I'm all tapped out when it comes
you
to
are.
Degrees. So.
Well, good luck. And
thank you
so much. And you're doing a great job for the United States and all of us here in the United States and elsewhere.
I appreciate that, Martha. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Martha Stewart here. As a devoted pet parent and culinary expert, I ensure my cats and dogs are fed the finest nutrition. My premium pet food features air-dried protein inclusion, whole fruits and vegetables, and never any fillers. Martha Stewart pet food formulas make it so easy to satisfy the dietary needs and taste preferences of your pets. Now all six delicious formulas are 50% off. And there's convenient home delivery on Chewy.com. No more lugging heavy bags, and your pets will thrive on the optimal nutrition and great taste.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.